The debate continues in Jacksonville. Should the city or should the city not spend nearly $700 million to deepen the St. John's River? Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app, listen anytime there or on iTunes. You can stream us live on our Facebook page right now as well. And just ahead, the pros and cons of deepening the river with a prominent transportation expert. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, how kids at Lee High School in Jacksonville are influencing changes in criminal justice reform. Plus, travel blogger Judy Wells, all of that and more ahead. But first this hour, we have new analysis today on the efforts from Jacksport to deepen the St. John's River Channel to accommodate bigger cargo ships. Container ports on the southeast coast of the U.S. have been investing billions in a competition to handle the next generation of bigger container ships that are going to be coming through a widened Panama Canal. They're called Panamax-ready ships. Now, for all of these ports, Far East import cargo is the big prize, and they're all competing up and down the eastern seaboard for federal, state, and local funds. There are 14 ports in Florida, so state support for them over the years has been somewhat fragmented. Not only that, Florida ports have lost market share in recent years to other ports up the southeast coast, like Georgia and South Carolina. They're all seeking funds for dredging or deepening, hoping to be able to compete in this field. The stakes are high. All of the ports are competing for new jobs with billions invested, and not everyone's going to come out a winner. Dale Lewis is an independent transportation and supply chain consultant and former CSX executive, and he's conducted extensive research on the full range of costs, opportunities, and risks associated with the deepening project at Jacksport. He presented these recently at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and in that talk, he called Jacksport's quest for deepening funds a high-cost, high-risk, but potentially high-reward project. But it's also one surrounded by complicated political issues and perhaps supported by overly optimistic economic forecasts. We're going to discuss it all as Dale Lewis joins us in studio. Thanks for being with us.
Morning, Melissa. Thanks for inviting me.
And what are your questions for Dale Lewis when it comes to his analysis of the pros and cons of deepening the St. John's River to accommodate bigger cargo ships? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax or weigh in on Facebook. So you've been focusing on this whole issue, whether it makes sense to deepen the river, how much it will cost, what are the opportunities, what are the risks? You presented this recently at MIT?
That's right.
Yeah. And what does your research show?
Well, the research blends together the strategic plans for each Florida port. You know, Jacksonville, Miami, Port Everglades have similar expansion plans, along with what's evolved as the Corps of Engineers' view of the prospects for Wilmington, Savannah, Charleston, and Florida. And the reason for doing this was to get an understanding of when the Corps says this project makes economic sense, what do they really mean by that? And when they say that, are they saying the same thing that Jacksport is, or are they saying something different? So what I've seen so far is that when the Corps says this makes economic sense, the Corps saying that if ships are larger, it will cost less per container to move goods, about $139 per 20-foot container. And it's saying that if that happens, those savings will be passed along to the end consumer. And when you do the math, it shows you that the end consumer can expect to save between 50 and 75 cents on their next microwave or ceiling fan. Mm-hmm. So when the Corps says this makes sense, they're not talking about jobs, taxes, or any other local impacts. It's the cost of the things that you buy, and on a per-person basis, it's a tiny, tiny benefit. If you flip over to Jacksport's view, there are a couple of really big differences. The first is Jacksport's work focuses on how many boxes will move, how many jobs might that create, and as a result, what would be the new tax revenues that flow to the state and to the local area. The really big issue is that the Corps has forecasted about 12 million TEUs of growth over the 20 or so years
and
of the project.
And TEU stands for?
Good question. A TEU is a 20-foot equivalent unit. If you look at the big boxes on ships, they're mostly 40-foot boxes, but the volume is expressed as though they were all 20. So a 10,000 TEU ship has about 5,000 40-foot boxes on it, or 10,000 smaller ones. The jobs and the revenue piece of this, though, are the big difference. The Corps says the Far Eastern trade will grow between 6 and 10% per year for about 10 years. It says the Puerto Rico trade won't grow. And then the other trades, South America, et cetera, would grow between 2 and 4%. When you blend all of that together, it gives you about a 3% growth rate overall. Jaxport says the same thing. 6, 8, 10% for the Far East, nothing for Puerto Rico, 2 to 4% for the other trades. So you'd think that the two forecasts would give you exactly the same number. Well, they don't. And the reason is that Jaxport says this money we're going to invest will fundamentally change our competitive position in the Southeast. And instead of gaining 12 million TEUs over the project life, we're going to capture 29 million. So Jaxport's forecast is around 130% higher in terms of growth than the Corps' forecast.
Okay, so they're not on the same page.
No.
549-2937, and in a moment we'll go to your calls for Dale Lewis. You did this research project, and I'm quoting here from an abstract you sent us. You've walked miles of track, operated interlocking levers, ridden locomotives, been through conductor training school, spent the night in crew hotels, climbed inside hundreds of freight cars, inventoried pallets coming out of intermodal containers, went line by line through operating budgets, measured boxes of consumer goods, timed trucks as they unloaded and reloaded, traced coffee beans from plant arrival in super sacks to final departure on their way to the stores, and you've spent hours wearing a headset listening to customer service employees as they deal with challenging customers. It sounds like a total immersion into all of the moving parts at the port that are relevant to this discussion.
That description really applies to my career for the last 25 years. Whether I was in trucking, rail, ship operations, what I found is to be an economist whose work really helps, you have to have walked through every operating process, seen it and touched it yourself, understand the time it takes, the equipment's involved, before you come back to your office and your computer and then begin to lay out what are the economics of this operation. If you don't understand it, you can't model it.
Based on your understanding over your long career and and research you've put into this, do you recommend the deepening project? Do you think it's worth the investment?
It's a great question. Let me stop one short of that first. 2.5 years ago, I was in a task force presentation. And in that presentation, a slide went up that said the cost of the project is $681 million. The benefits of the project are $800 to $900 million. So the people in the room saw that, and what they saw was a slide that said the benefits are clearly much larger than the cost. Having been a finance vice president and having presented business cases for $500 million, billion, and more projects to CEO and board-level operators, I walked out saying, this is not complete. If Savannah, Charleston, and Houston are spending $4 billion to grow their business, how could it be possible that for $681 million we can get into the same league? There's a big disconnect there. And on the other end of it, if you look at the benefits forecast, the benefits forecast says if our most optimistic assumptions, this 130% more growth in the core, come true over the next couple of decades, here's the present value of all those benefits. So when I came home and told my wife, I wouldn't be allowed to present this in a boardroom anywhere. I wouldn't allow any of my analysts to present it in a boardroom anywhere, because when you begin to ask the questions, how much more money does it take, those answers aren't there.
So you think this is an overly rosy forecast, in other words?
I think the presentations I have seen are incomplete.
Okay. Now, let me jump in, though, and ask you, what about the argument coming from the port coming from all of, pretty much all of the political and business leadership in Jacksonville that's weighed in on this, that if we even if their forecasts are overly optimistic, that if we don't do something, Jacksport will just continue to fall further and further behind its competitive position vis-a-vis the other ports up and down the Southeast Coast.
Okay. So you'd have to believe a couple of things. One is you'd have to believe that going to 45 feet or 47 feet would immediately make you successful or make you dramatically more competitive. And what I know is that Charleston went from shallower than Savannah to deeper than Savannah 12 years ago. They have continued to lose market share from that point. And Charleston is a 2 million TEU port. They're where we would hope to be in 8 to 10 years. So just having deep water doesn't do it. The other thing is the premise that if we don't become a large international container port, that the port will lose its value, is not borne out in the port's own projections. If you read through the strategic plan, you read through all the presentations, what you see is those non-deep water trades, Puerto Rico container traffic, automotive traffic, and other things don't require depth over 40 feet. They're worth in the neighborhood of $100 million per year of state and local tax revenues today. And the port's planning documents show them growing to more than 40% more than that over the next 20 years. So the fundamental base business we have here is good. It's well run. The port has a lot of successes to talk about. So the question really is, this is a discretionary investment. We just started in the international business in 2009 for the Far East. We've grown that, or the port has grown that, to between 300 and 350,000 TEUs today. The question here is, are we going to make the discretionary investment to try to make that the dominant part of what the port does?
And to be clear, with a near $700 million tab, the feds would kick in some, the state and city would be expected to contribute between what, 100 to 200 million. Is that about right?
Right. So the dredging alone, the nominal cost is $680 million, but there's a time value of money and it takes years to do it. The Corps says when you consider the time value of money, the cost is more like $870 million just for dredging. The non-federal share would be about $470, and you could expect that Jacksport and the city's piece of that could be in the $150 to $200 million range. But again, that's dredging only. There's a lot more you have to do.
Where's that money going to come from in Duval County? $150 to $200 million?
I don't know. That's an issue that the city council and the mayor are, they have to struggle with that every day. With police, firemen,
sure.
Pension, and other issues.
Yeah. Okay. Lots of calls, meanwhile, for Dale Lewis. He's an independent transportation and supply chain consultant. He recently presented his analysis of the pros and cons of the Jacksport Deepening Project at MIT. And let's go to your calls at 549-2937. Scott is in St. Johns County. Hi, Scott. Good morning.
Good morning. My question was about one of those other expenses. I just turned on the radio and heard the talk about dredging. And I live on a little inlet right off Trout River, and every time they dredge in the river, I lose about 6 inches of water at low tide. The mud is the last time they dredged up underneath 95, we lost like a foot on that inlet. And is there any money in what the city's going to do to, I bought my house because it's on the water. Now it's only on the water about, 17, 18 hours out of the day. Losing property value just because somebody wants to make the river deeper, and it sounds like there's no real economic benefit to it. But are there any plans in that contingency money to fix land damage by the dredging?
Thanks, James.
There's a small.
Thanks. That wasn't James. We're going to James in a minute. Go ahead, Dale.
There's a small amount of mitigation money for environmental issues in the overall package, but by small, less than 10%.
James on the north side. Go ahead, James.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, James.
Oh, good morning, Melissa. I got two questions. One is what is it about these projects that make them cost so much? I mean, it just seemed like these astronomical costs on these projects. And two is, if we're going to dredge down, and I was listening to the previous caller, to these depths, and plus we're supplying water, what I heard, to Central Florida, I mean, can the river handle that? I mean, or will the water table drop? I mean, will I walk out into my, yard, because I stay on the river too, and I'm basically going to look at mud. I mean, can the river handle this kind of work? And I'll take my answer off.
Yeah, thanks for that, James. And we're getting emails about that too, Dale. Here's one from a listener. Has your guest analysis taken in the environmental impacts to local shrimping and fisheries, ecotourism, recreation, increases of salinity much further upstream, which would impact nursing areas for fisheries, the environmental argument, basically, not to do it, which, you know, groups like the St. John's Riverkeeper have argued against this.
Right. The environmental side of this, first off, to really do economics right, you have to make sure there's no externalities created, meaning you do these three things that help yourself. One of them hurts a neighbor, but you don't count that in your cost. The environmental piece of this is important, but that's being really well covered by other folks who are looking at it.
You're looking at the dollars and
right?
cents.
I'm looking at the business case aside from environmental issues.
Okay, so let's go to David on the south side. Go ahead, David.
Yes, in your analysis, have you... laid out who gets the money and how much stays in town from the construction of this or the spending of these millions and millions of dollars? And what about the cost of undercutting the bridges with the increased current flows, especially downtown where we've had some collapses of some shoring that's pretty old? When that more flow comes in, more flow goes out, the river flows faster at the downtown area. But how much of the money will stay in Jacksonville from this construction, and how much at present stays here in town and is just a pass-through, or how much do we subsidize others?
Yeah. Thank you, David.
I think you're actually asking two or three different questions in that. One, the question is, you know, who will do the dredging? And at this point, the Corps is in the bidding and estimating process, and the dredging company could be local, could be from somewhere far away. There's a lot of demand for dredging up and down the East Coast at this point as multiple projects are in place, so I don't know the answer to that. I do know that the Corps of Engineers has looked at the flows in and around the port. They coordinate with the port operating folks, and that there are significant dollars being invested to shore up pier operations and those things at the port. To be able to handle both the water flows and the changing type of cargo that we'll handle.
All right. And Mike is on the west side. Go ahead, Mike. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I had a question with regards specifically to the economics of the port. My understanding of what makes Jacksonville an attractive port for shippers is a combination of two things. One is the port fees, and second, the access to other intermodals, like access to the interstate system. Access, you know, we've got 10 and 95 sitting right here. Access to rail. Those are the things that make our port attractive to the vast majority of ships that would be still shipping cargo even after they start building the larger. Even after they're, you know, we have. Those ships aren't going to go away, and they're not going to stop getting built. So what can you say to the economics of what makes the port actually attractive relative to some of the other ports in the up and down the East Coast? And thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
That's a good question.
Lots of great questions from our callers today, yeah.
So Jacksonville has a container business today. Given the Corps' demand forecast, I think that's likely to continue to grow. If you didn't have good intermodal and rail connections, you wouldn't be having the business you have today. The big issue is not so much what you have here locally, but it's where are the customers? And this is something we haven't touched on yet. But when you do this sort of planning, you have to understand who your real customer is. It's not the ocean carrier. Your real customer is Nike, Bose, Target, IKEA, Home Depot. the people that you want to influence to build an import distribution center to serve the Southeast region near your port. Let me give you an example. Just outside of Savannah, near Statesboro, Walmart has a very large import distribution center, one of five they run in the United States. That center serves every regional DC from Knoxville, Tennessee, down to Miami, nine locations and 48 million people. If that particular distribution center had been located just west of Jacksonville compared to Savannah, and let's say about 30% of the people using Savannah today use a similar distribution system to Walmart, you'd add between 14 and 18 million truck miles a year of cost into the distribution system for a Walmart-type company. So it's not so much what rail and highway we have here. It's where are the customers for these big retailers, and where are they likely to put their distribution centers to minimize transportation and handling costs.
You also brought with you today data you analyzed from the Florida Ports Council. Now, this goes beyond Jacksport. This is sort of a look in the aggregate at all of Florida's ports in terms of what they forecast for container volumes and what actually happened. And according to this analysis you brought, for the last 20 years, Florida ports have predicted a much higher volume than what they actually did in terms of moving these TEUs. So that would, I would guess, I mean, you tell me, Dale, but I would guess that's something that is just probably the nature of the beast in the port business. You know, I would think that goes beyond Florida ports, that, you know, of course a company's going to say, project a really rosy outcome and not always reach those projections. So given that, why is this data important to your overall analysis?
We've gone from putting money in for capital at the port to maintain current operations to investing capital to grow into a new type of business segment. In a private business, your proposal to do that, you'd have to be able to look at the person making the proposal and say, what's this person's track record for delivering on growth forecasts? Because this investment is all about a growth forecast. So to do that, I went back to the Florida Ports Council and looked at the last 20 years of five-year plans. And what I find is that each year, a huge five-year gain is published. You roll forward 5 years, and between 10 and 15 cents on the dollar of that growth forecast has come true. It appears to be a system in which there's not a post-audit of forecast versus results. And so what you see over 20 years is that forecasts continue to rise even though the cargo volumes really don't. So for me to have confidence in making this investment, I'd feel better if, you know, the person asking for the funds had a strong track record of delivering on a forecast made in the past.
And you've presented this around town. What's the reaction been?
It's been mixed. You know, there are some folks who think the only task left now is to go get the money, federal money, state money, to fund the project. There are others who, when you show them the total cost picture and the revenue risk picture, who push back from the table and go, wow, this is not what I thought we had here. What can we do about it? And I talked about the cost being higher than the dredging. Can I give you a couple of chunks of that? One of the big things when you read the strategic plan for Florida's, or not for all the ports, but for Jacksport in particular, it's pretty clear that it takes three deep water, high capacity container terminals to deliver the total volume that's in the plan. Well, today we have one high capacity deep water terminal, which is TRAPAC. It's operating below capacity today, but it can really scale up. So as I looked through the plan, what I saw was to create the second and then the third high-capacity terminal, there are four tenants on the west end of Blount Island. You'd have to pay to relocate them away from that location because it has deep water, stand up somewhere else for them to do business, and the relocation cost in the plan is $500 million to move those four tenants less than a mile. Along with that, the plan shows $200 million invested to create the footprint. Now, once you've cleared off the spot, $200 million to build the footprint for a new high-capacity terminal. And then an operator would come in and put in their own equipment to actually run the thing. So there, I see $700 million in relocation and terminal development costs that aren't part of the discussion at all today.
Well, now they are. Okay. we hope you'll come back and share your thoughts as we continue to cover this. And we'll continue to host other points of view on this. It's an important topic for this area. Dale Lewis, thank you for being with us and sharing this with us. You're an independent transportation and supply chain consultant. Go to, if you want to get in touch with them, it's data@southeasternports.net.
Right. And the website is southeasternports.net. And everything I've mentioned here today is explained in detail there.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Really interesting stuff. And much more still ahead later. A look ahead to the big Palm Valley Storytelling Weekend. We'll tell you about it. Also, travel expert Judy Wells. But up next, how students at Jacksonville's Lee High School are having a real impact on criminal justice reform. We'll meet them next.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
LAX, Los Angeles International Airport, is huge and in the middle of a huge upgrade.
Almost every terminal either has been or is underway with a renovation program.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the CEO of LAX. We'll have that story for you, the numbers from Wall Street, and the rest of the day's business news as well. Next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
How is Jacksonville spending our tax money? For years, city leaders have talked about bringing jobs and updating infrastructure to make the city more attractive. But are those investments spread across the city equally? Join our panel of experts and moderator Melissa Ross for a live, interactive, televised discussion on June 29th. To send your questions or to RSVP, go to wjct.org/events.
Hello, I'm Doug Hansard, and I listen to the Florida Times Union On Demand as read by WJCT Radio Reading Service volunteers. The sound quality is excellent. This is a great asset for people like me, sightless and on the go. The Florida Times Union Daily on the radio reading website at wjct.org/radio reading. Take advantage of it, and while you're there, register as a listener.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge, Tuesday through Saturday nights.
Welcome back. Well, there are a group of extraordinary young men at Lee High School, part of a class that calls itself the EVAC Movement. These students have launched a school-wide campaign to help their fellow students understand the bonds they all have in common. They are the winners of a national contest, the Kindness Challenge, sponsored by Harvard and the Kind Foundation. And the surprise announcement of that award came recently at the end of an exceptional year for the students. They've done everything from meet with former President Barack Obama at UNF to becoming youth advisors to local justice system officials like State Attorney Melissa Nelson. And they've gained the ability to convene top city officials and command their attention as they work to reform the local criminal justice system. We are pleased to welcome two of the members of the EVAC Movement, students Devin Brown and Alan McCullough. Hey, guys.
Hey.
How you doing?
And their teacher, Amy Donofrio from Lee High School. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Amy, more from you in just a moment, but first let's talk to the students. Devin, let's start with you. How did the EVAC Movement at Lee High School get started?
It got started from sharing our stories. At first, we were just a class on a third period, but then we started sharing our stories, and we related to each other, and we found out our struggles were the same, and we wanted to find a change in it, so we put our struggles to use.
And Alan, evac is cave, spelled backward, is that right? It means to sort of mm-hmm. come out of the dark, is mm-hmm. that right?
Yeah, for Plato's allegory cave, uh-huh. it's something my teacher, Ms. Donna Friel, taught us, and that came with helping us build a name.
And your goal, and by the way, there's a school-wide campaign with the hashtag Your Story Is Mine. You want to make a positive impact on the violence involving young people in Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm.
How are you guys going about that?
We trying to connect with people to really try to integrate everyone. And we try to make our struggles be known with people that relate to us. They can connect with us and we can have a bond with other people. Because mm-hmm. we know, like, this community is really divided into groups, but we're all much alike that we don't know it, though. So,
Amy Donofrio, you're the teacher of these students. You must be pretty proud. Can you share a little bit about the impact they've had, not just at Lee High School, mm-hmm. but beyond it?
It's been pretty crazy. I mean, we're literally just a class at Lee High School, and just a group of people came together and decided things don't have to be the way that they are in Jacksonville, in our country, in our world. And the community support has been unbelievable and really has helped us keep going, even when at times tasks have been very difficult. I mean, to work on the Your Story Is Mine campaign, you know, sometimes they were staying until 8-9 at night on a Friday night, making sure it was getting done. But we've had people reach out to us from all over the country, and especially important to us right here in Jacksonville.
And you've met with State Attorney Nelson, other officials. What has that? How has that been impactful, do you think, as the EVAC kids are really, they have a seat at the table when these issues are being discussed?
I think it speaks very highly to our city, to elect officials like Melissa Nelson and like Mayor Curry, who want to give youth a seat at the table. I think that's pretty unique, and I think that the youth have taken full advantage of it. And I think as a result, the solutions our city is coming up with are more authentic and more effective.
Devin Brown, what are some of the ways you think that the adults are listening to you guys?
I would say they're listening to us because they'll come back and show us how they're trying to work on it. You know, they don't just blow it off and they come back again on a new situation. They come back from the plans that we made and show us how they've been trying to make a change and how they're working on to make a change.
And Alan, you and some of the other students have really shared some pretty harrowing stories about mm-hmm. what kids at your school have been dealing with. Can you tell us a few of them?
Yeah, we really tried to focus on major topics that we know that really is a problem in the community, and that's homelessness, you know, having a parent incarcerated and suffering loss, whether that's by, you know, death or absence from a family member. And we tried to cover all that. And, you know, I feature on the homelessness topic because I once went through that at a point in my life. And because we know that them certain topics is very broad and it covers a lot of the community. And we try to get people to relate to us, and we really form a connection with people that we didn't know that was going through the same struggles we go through.
Amy Donofrio, I'm sorry. Is it your hope that the EVAC movement can spread to other schools?
It's my hope that the mindset can spread to other schools. We're not an organization. We feel strongly about being a movement. We want people's mindset to shift. And so it's my hope that in its own way, yes, it can spread.
Well, it's inspiring to meet you all. And by the way, the hashtag on social media is Your Story Is Mine. Check it out online. And kudos to you, Devin Brown and Alan McCullough. Are you both juniors or seniors at Lee?
I'm a senior.
I'm a junior.
Where are you going to go to college or career after school?
University of South Florida.
Okay. And you've got another year to go.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And Amy Donofrio is their student, or their teacher rather, at Lee. Thanks for being here as well.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
on the next Fresh Air.
This is America. Here, the righteous have no reason to fear.
That's Giancarlo Esposito as Gus Fring in Better Call Saul, the prequel to Breaking Bad. We'll talk about Esposito's characters and his own life. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Save the date for Girls' Day Out, Saturday, August 26, 2017 at the Hyatt Riverfront. Join us for a day of pampering and making time to care for you. Be inspired by health experts, free screenings, and great door prizes. Keynote speaker is Jennifer Berman, MD, co-host of the Emmy Award-winning talk show, The Doctors. Go to wjct.org/girlsdayout to register.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon, the best in classic and modern blues, as part of WJCT's After Hours, tonight at 11 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, this weekend in Palm Valley, a special event highlighting the region's unique history. It's a storytelling weekend and a way to capture past generations' memories about Palm Valley. This also ties into an initiative focused on the area's future. Here with more, Deb Chapin and Brian Anderson. They are with the Palm Valley Greenway Alliance. That's a group working to bring a trail system, historic district, fishing pier, and more to Palm Valley. Thanks for being with us, you guys.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
All right, Deb, let's begin with you. Tell us a little bit about this event. It's Saturday, the Palm Valley Storytelling Day. What's on tap?
So what we've got going on is an exciting sort of a celebrate Palm Valley history. It's called the Palm Valley Fest. And we are bringing in a lot of the historic family members that, you know, were settlers in the area. And we're going to try and capture their history on video. So the objective is to bring in as many people to, you know, tell their stories and capture that so that we can integrate that into our future efforts.
Because Palm Valley used to really exemplify this sort of old Florida feel, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The history of the survival ship of the settlers there is incredibly interesting and fascinating.
A survival ship?
Well, just living off the land. In, you know, from the old families, and there's a lot of history caught on books, you know, and at the History Museum, but there's not a whole lot of video. And for future generations, really, we need to have digital information and history captured. So that's our goal.
And this ties into a larger initiative. Brian Anderson, tell us about the Palm Valley Greenway Alliance and what you're trying to accomplish.
Well, 3 years ago, we were living in Palm Valley and riding our bikes. My wife was hit by a car, and the first thing she said in the ER is, I guess we need to make our community safer to get around.
Sure.
And that's kind of how my energy started. And Deb kind of took the ball and kept it going and finding out ways to make Palm Valley be a lot safer place, keep its history, and keep its feel.
So you want to build a trail system, a historic district, and a fishing pier, and more. There's an ambitious plan here, it sounds like. Yeah?
Absolutely. So it started out as a safety, sort of a necessity issue, and there's been trails there for centuries that people have used. And I was familiar with that off-the-grid trail system from my equestrian background. So the truth is that the vision started to grow to become recreational. Maybe we can do some preservation and create some more parks and recs. And as you move along this greenway and trail system to tell a story, and so it's an experiential vision. So the vision keeps growing, and the wharf is a new addition to that vision, and it looks really exciting.
And we've got a call from Mary in St. John's. Mary, thanks for calling. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Thanks for having me. I just want to make a statement in support of what the Palm Valley Greenway is doing. They are setting an example for the entire county. Recently, a survey was done by Parks and Recreation asking what the citizens of St. Johns County wanted. And overwhelmingly, 83% of the people said their number one recreational need is greenways and trails. And the Palm Valley Greenway Association is really setting an example for the rest of the county, and we are trying to follow up. There's now a St. Johns County Greenway Trails Coalition that's following Deb's example.
Very cool. Thanks for that. Got a lot of support out there.
Absolutely. I think we've really started a momentum here, and there's a lot of initiatives, as Mary said, throughout the county. People are trying to, you know, carve out the potential opportunities for the future so we can still capture some recreational and some history.
And they can come out to this Palm Valley Storytelling Day event Saturday. How can people be part of this?
So it's open to the public, and it's at the American Legion Post 233 on North Wilderness Trail in Palm Valley, which is a historical site. And we're going to have, you know, folk music, barbecue, beverages, storytelling. We've got a lot of the old families coming out that want to tell their stories.
And there are some families, correct me if I'm wrong, that many generations in Palm Valley, right?
Many generations. Yeah. So we've got Meichlers, Osterreichers, McCormicks, possibly the Bears. And this is just the beginning of a series because we really can't capture everybody's story. But we do want to get some of the older generation stories while they're still
and preserve here. Them while people are still with us.
Right.
Yeah.
Preserve
Very
them
cool stuff. And Brian, people can learn more about the Greenway Alliance where?
Well, you can go on Facebook first and like our page and just continue to keep your ears open for any other possibilities of getting it to come to fruition.
Well, it's Saturday, the inaugural Palm Valley Storytelling Day from noon to 5 at the American Legion Post 233. Brian Anderson, Deb Chapin with the Palm Valley Greenway Alliance. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And up next, Judy Wells.
This Going Green segment is brought to you by the Unitarian Universalist Church of Jacksonville.
Do you ever wonder about that moment when two people click?
I don't think that there's anything that really feels better than that.
In that moment, what exactly is it that clicks?
What clicks? And if we can know what clicks, can we learn how to make it click more?
This week on Radiolab, stories of soulmates, particles colliding, and the desperate search for symmetry.
Saturdays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Listen to Hotsy Totsy Sunday nights at 9, celebrating the music from the 20s and 30s, only on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world, your music.
So everything is a Hotsy Totsy
And welcome back. Well, finally this hour, is it Europe's next hotspot? Judy Wells says Poland should be on your list of places to visit. That's a little polka music, by the way.
I know.
Judy Wells, good morning.
Good morning.
Polka, polka, polka.
Polka, yes. Kresmer, Kresmer, Kresmer.
Now, you just got back from Poland.
Got back from Poland. I was very fortunate to be invited on LOT Airlines' newly reinstated trip route from Newark to Warsaw, and then we went to Krakow for a bit. But a steady stream of Americans visits Poland every year because Chicago is the second largest Polish city.
That's right. I used to live there. Every nail shop in Chicago is run by a Polish lady.
I know.
I'm not kidding.
Really?
You.
They're not the Vietnamese Polish people.
Yeah. I mean, you think of nail shops, you know, as being run mainly by Asian Americans. Not in Chicago.
Not in Chicago.
Yeah. The Poles have it locked down.
But increasingly, America and the world are discovering that it's a reasonably priced center, Warsaw, reasonably priced center of interesting history and sites, beautiful countrysides, and welcoming hosts. After centuries of struggling to rule their own nation, the Poles have finally achieved their goal and want to show off. They want us. And LOT, the national airline and most aggressive airline in Europe, is making it easier than ever. They've added direct flights between Los Angeles and Warsaw and Chicago and Krakow. And as I said recently, he added one from Newark to Warsaw, direct flight. And unlike other airlines, if you get their special comfort coach, so to speak, they have dedicated attendants for that. Better meals. You are definitely separated from the back of the bus.
Mm-hmm.
It's worth the bit. And of course, if you can go business, when you're on their Dreamliners, you have the flat lie bed seats, and it's wonderful. But Warsaw.
And when you go to Warsaw, of course, it was leveled in the war.
More than 70% was destroyed. The Soviets added about another 10 to 15%.
So it's all new construction.
It's all new construction. However, Old Town looks exactly like it did before. Even the Soviets realized the advantage of recreating this. And they did an excellent job. However, they also gifted the city with this gosh-awful Institute of Culture and Science that everybody hates. And
really?
The Warsaw residents' answer to it is to build skyscrapers around it so no one will see it. And as they say, the best view in town is from the top of that center because you don't have to look at it.
Now, what about the history of the Holocaust? That's something that's laced all throughout Poland.
It has.
Just the tragedy of how deeply affected.
It's impossible to ignore. From the mid-13th century, Poland was known as the most enlightened and tolerant of European countries. Its rulers gave Jews all the rights of Christians. Scholars, musicians, merchants, writers, scientists, they all flourished, and so did the country. But it changed with the 20th century with the rise of anti-Semitism exacerbated by fascists and the Nazis. Well, there were 3.5 million Jews, the largest percentage of the world's Jewish population, living in Poland prior to World War II. More than 3 million of them were killed by war's end.
Mm-hmm.
However, their Polish neighbors did their best to thwart the Nazis and the Gestapo. More Poles have been cited and honored by the various Jewish communities for saving their efforts to save the Poles than in any other country, more than 6,000.
That's fascinating history.
It is. And you will find memorials to the victim of the Holocaust dotting the cities and countryside, and there are always fresh flowers around them.
Now,
it's not forgotten, but and they have one of their good museums is there are two great museums, the Warsaw Rising Museum, which honors all of those who fought the Nazis, and particularly the group of ghetto residents that on August 1st, 1944, it had a doomed effort, but they tried to defeat the Nazis
uprising.
And hoping that the Soviets would come in, they were the closest, and would take over and be benevolent, and that didn't happen.
So amazing history, amazing culture, and a little more affordable than some European countries.
Oh, it's very
countries.
Affordable. The hotels, the food.
How's the food?
The food is outstanding. Elixir Dom Vodka is a restaurant that has a collection of 500 different kinds of vodkas. Vodka's the specialty in Poland. They say they invented it.
Did they really?
And they do tastings, flights of tastings, paired with food. And it's outstanding. Der Elephant is like an American bistro, a huge American bistro. A wide array of choices from pierogies to tartars and creative burgers. They even have a supervised children's room so the adults can stay and linger and enjoy the pianists that they have from time to time playing playing music in the afternoon and for brunch.
So this is not a country that I think it's fair to say most Americans think of when they think of going to Europe. But you say, Judy Wells, you might want to consider this
as an off-the-beaten path destination. Well, it's also at a point where it is really moving toward gentrification in that ownership is still in a tangle. They have not been, like the art, the buildings. Nobody knows who owns the building. They're still arguing over it. Mm-hmm. And as that settled, everybody moves in. Great restaurants, great galleries, fun areas. If you really are interested, if you like the zookeeper's wife, go to the Warsaw Zoo. You can go into their home and see.
Yeah, that was a recent movie.
It was.
And we're almost out of time, but where are you off to next?
Next, I'm heading out west. I just got back from the Arctic.
Of course you did. You're Judy Wells.
And I'm heading
You're a
out,
world traveler.
I'm heading out west on my annual Good Girls and Badlands tour.
Oh, very nice.
We'll be
nice.
Blogging about it. Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming.
Shouldn't that say Bad Girls in the Badlands? I'm just curious.
Well, actually, I think it's more like Bad Girls in the Good Lands or Pokey Girls in all lands.
Well, we'll close with a little more polka music in honor of you, Judy Wells, the great Judy Wells. She is traveling the world and having a fabulous time doing it. Go to her website, wellsworld.net, for more about her recent trip to Poland. Thanks for being
here.
And
a few bargains I added.
I'm Melissa Ross. 1A's up next. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Someone stole a kishka, someone stole a kishka, someone stole a kishka from the butcher shop. Who stole the kishka? Who stole the kishka? Who stole the kishka? Someone call the cop. Round and firm and fully packed, it was standing on the rack. Someone stole the kishka when I turned my back. Who stole the kishka? Who stole the kishka? Who stole the kishka? Won't you bring it back? Shinga, take my fine kielbasi. You can take my pirogi, but give me back my kishka. Who stole the kishka? Who stole the kishka? Who stole the kishka? Won't you bring it back? Yasho found the kishka. Yasho found the kishka.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.